playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. It was the end of an era in Radioland this week with the announcement that Larry Gogan, after 40 years on 2FM, is moving to a digital platform. The news of Larry's defection to RTE Gold saw him trending on Twitter, much to his amusement.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline.
I've waited 40 years for Larry Gogan to say that. And he only agreed to do it on the day that RTE announced that Larry Gogan, after 40 years in 2FM, Larry is finishing on 2FM. Is that congratulations or commiserations, Larry?
Oh, it's kind of moving to gold, Joe.
The digital
platform. Station, yeah. More modern, you know, digital.
And do you know you're trending?
Oh, so they're telling me I'm trending today. Yeah. What does that tell me?
Well, how are you, Larry?
Actually, I'm fine, Joe, really.
And you've had your health knocks, unfortunately.
Yeah, I have to go do dialysis. I'm on dialysis, you know, three times a week.
And wow.
Yeah, that's a bit of a bummer. They're lovely people out there in Sandyford. It's just time-consuming, you know.
So what is it? You're collected in the morning?
They collect you and they bring you out and then you hook up to a machine and you're there for 3 hours. They hook you off the machine, but they take all your blood out, wash it and put it back in again. So a very clean blood, really.
So how long have you been on dialysis?
Since about October. But now I'm fine. I've legs like Marilyn Monroe, I think, you know.
But you also said to me just before we started, just your voice is brilliant, as always. Oh, what a gift to have you open this programme. But you said, you remarked to somebody recently when they saw you, you're a bit slower now on your feet.
Yeah, that's arthritis, yeah.
Yeah.
And arthritis in my knees, yeah, that's right.
What did you say to them when they said it?
Some fellow was giving out, saying something to me, and I said, well, the only thing is I don't talk through my knees, you know.
And you never talk to any other part of your body?
No, I hope try not to, Joe.
And it seemed like battalions of listeners, as well as all the up-and-coming bands he championed, rang the live line to say thank you and to wish him well. Boys owners Ronan Keating and Keith Duffy were among them. Apparently Larry was the first DJ to play a Boys Own song on his radio show back in 1993.
Working My Way Back to You was the very first single that Larry played for us. We were all in a car. I remember it well. We were driving around Ireland. Paul Keogh, that ran Polydor at the time, was driving us around in his Jaguar to do radio stations around the country. And we pulled in on the side of the road and Larry showed that he played Boys Own's Working My Way Back to You. And it was a mega moment for us. I'll never forget it as long as I live.
No, I remember as well, but I remember it differently. Ronan was in Paul Keogh's Jaguar. I was in his assistant's Ford Fiesta behind you, Ronan. You always got the nice car.
Ronan and Keith, and Ronan, to begin with you, in your case in particular, your mother, Mary, who I met, she would have been into Larry Gogan.
That's the legend that he is. The golden hour and also the just a minute quiz. Legendary stories that came off the back of that. I mean, still today we tell people when we travel around the world, we talk about the just a minute quiz and the funny jokes like the Taj Mahal or all of those funny different gags, which are legendary. You need to get them all compiled into one podcast because they were just, you know, so brilliant, so funny, so innocent, and great memories. So, Larry, thank you so much for all that you've done for the nation as a broadcaster, a live broadcaster. You're a true legend, and, yeah, I wish you the best in what you're doing. Thank you from all of us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the great music, lads. Great.
Ronan Keating and Keith Duffy. Well, the manager of the Saw Doctors, Ollie Jennings, also has reason to love Larry.
In the summer of 1990, an unknown band from Tube called the Saw Doctors released I Used to Love Her, and Larry was the first to play it, and he said, I predict this great things for this band, and a week later we were in the top 20 and it went on to be 9 weeks number one. I mean, the great thing about Larry is I think he had an instinct for hit music. He had his finger on the pulse of what the public wanted. He loved music. I've met him a few times, and he's a great store of interest and knowledge of music. Fair play to him, and thank you from the Saw Doctors.
Thank you very much, Ollie.
It's a great song, isn't it, Larry?
Terrific song. Marvellous song.
Brilliant. Where did it come from? Yes. Davey and Leo.
Well, I used to see her up the chapel when she went to Sunday Mass.
It's great.
How'd she go up to receive? I'd kneel down there and watch her pass.
The glory of her ass.
I used to love her once.
just a soundtrack to so many people's lives, isn't it?
Collecting for concern on Christmas Eve.
The great song.
Collecting from Christmas Eve.
Yeah, terrific song.
The Saw Doctors. Well, Ronan Collins has been a pal of Lars all the way back to the days of the television club in Harcourt Street.
He's a great innovator. If you look back over 50 years when Larry started on Radio Éireann, as it was then, Larry was the first personality broadcaster. He was the first one who brought his personality to the job. Like, if you listen to old recordings of Gay Byrne, even back then, it was still clipped, it was BBC style. Larry came in with this breezy, joyous, happy approach. He was a DJ. He was a DJ who adored Alan Freeman. It was his great influence, I think, and spurred Larry on to the style that he had and continues to have. And right through all the years, they tried to change him. The producers would say, well, Larry, maybe we'll do it this way. And Larry would say, well, no, I'm doing it this way. Because he was forceful enough to know that the Larry Gogan that came in on a Monday was the same Larry Gogan that came in on a Tuesday and a Wednesday and a Thursday. His consistency was unbelievable. And his consistency professionally was only matched by his consistency as a person. Good-natured, generous with his time, generous with his advice, and I am proud to call him my pal. And I walk away from a conversation with Larry feeling better. So it's no wonder that people walk away from the radio having heard Larry and they feel better after it, because he's the king.
Ronan Collins and Dave Fanning also rang in to pay homage.
He is the best person that ever worked in radio, full stop. The nicest guy ever. And I'll tell you one thing. You've mentioned what you call the Just a Minute Quiz, but you forgot one or two little things that he does in Just a Minute Quiz, which is this. One of the things he does is people do really badly. Like, they don't get 15 or 16 answers right. They get about 3 or 4 right. So to make them feel better and to confuse the audience as how well they did, he goes, OK, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You got 3. And like, he had these ways of just, he didn't care if they got them right or wrong. He just wanted people to feel good. And that's really what he does in life as well. But boy, he still knows how. He's no shrinking violet when it comes to good old gossip, like in any good office. He knows how to stick the boot in.
Okay. Thank you, David. Finish the programme today. Larry Gogan, you started 40 years ago on these platforms, 2FM in this building, and now you're bookending it, your last few days on 2FM. Finish as you started.
All right. Well, from Joe and Larry, it's bye-bye to you, and we leave you with the Boomtown Rats, Like Clockwork.
Larry Gogan, the King, Ledge, heard on Liveline's tribute programme on Tuesday. Over on Morning Ireland, Dan Healy, head of 2FM and head of RTE Radio Strategy, spoke with Brian Dobson.
Day of great significance, although Larry is not retiring.
No, he's not. I mean, what Larry has done for Ireland is play the hits for 40 years, for longer really. Incidentally, 2FM is actually 40 years old on the 31st of May this year, and he was there from the very beginning. And I think that his love of music, his love of now, is what has made him relevant. And his age has always been irrelevant because he's been so relevant. And that gorgeous, warm voice. You know, nowadays presenters, personalities, they're talking about what they've had for breakfast. They're spending so much time on Instagram. Larry went into a live radio studio, loved the mic, spoke to the audience, and talked about what he loved most, which was music.
Yeah, the voice is unchanged.
Unchanged. I mean, that's a great gift that you can teach nobody. But if you're a young presenter who wants to have a life as a music broadcaster, all you need to do is listen to Larry. Tight, warm, crisp links, and all he does is talk about the music.
Dan Healy, head of 2FM, heard on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. BBC correspondent Orla Geeran has reported extensively from war-torn regions around the world, the Balkans, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Israel, Libya, and most recently has filed compelling dispatches from Yemen on the heartbreaking humanitarian crisis there. But she was back on home ground last Sunday in Dublin in conversation with Miriam O'Callaghan, and she recalled the early days in the RTÉ newsroom when she was sent to cover the Balkan conflict in the early 90s.
The safety and security aspect of reporting has changed enormously since I started. And I remember setting out from RTE to go to Sarajevo when the barricades were going up and asking Tom McCochrane, who was the security correspondent, legendary security correspondent, if he could put me in touch with the army, which he very kindly did. And they very kindly gave me a military green bulletproof vest, but without the plates, because they explained to me that the plates were an item of ordnance and they couldn't hand those over. So off I went with this green flak jacket with no plates, and a much more experienced American colleague and friend said to me after a few days, he said, you know, Orla, that's not going to stop anything except it might stop you catching cold, you know. It's very different now. I mean, all of the organisations, the major ones, take safety very, very seriously. I mean, sadly, we have to. You know, the attitude to journalists reporting on front lines has changed. And I think 20 years ago, we were seen as honest brokers and innocent parties and so on. You know, now we're fair game. Now we're targets, actually, in a way, particularly for kidnapping. So the approach has changed and we've had to change as well. And we would have a team of people in the BBC who deal with safety and security. They wouldn't be involved on every story because, you know, you wouldn't need them. But they would be involved in some cases, and in some cases they'd be heavily involved.
Orla believes that you take the risk when you take the assignment. That sense that while you can plan and be careful, in certain circumstances, things can go badly wrong, even when everyone has done their absolute best.
And you mentioned earlier that you lost some very good colleagues along the way. Were they people you worked with or people like Marie Coven you knew? Or?
I mean, I didn't know Marie particularly well, but our paths crossed. She was extraordinary. I mean, she was an extraordinary journalist, but she was also hilarious and great company. And I'm just reading her book at the moment that was written by Lindsay Hilsum. And it's a wonderful read because it captures her in all of her extraordinary vibrancy and commitment and courage and doubt. It's not just about how Marie died, it's about how Marie lived and everything that she was while she was alive. She was the bravest of the brave. I mean, without a doubt, Marie always went further, stayed longer, did more. And one of the last times I saw her, we were on a boat together going into Misrata in Libya when it was under siege. And we had all managed to get onto this boat that was being operated by the IOM, the Organisation for Migration. They were going in to take out migrant workers who were trapped in Libya because of the conflict. And the boat was going to do quite a quick turnaround. It was 2 days. So we were all going in and coming out on the same boat. Anyway, we got in. She and I wound up staying in the same kind of journalistic flop house, you know, this guy who sort of gave us shelter and took us in, and we were very grateful. And our paths crossed a few times, you know, running in and out. And she had done something very typical of Marie and of Paul Conroy, the amazing photographer she worked with. They had gone out for a night in an ambulance. And that was Marie, because where is the ambulance going to be except in the most dangerous place, responding to where the attacks have just happened? And that was the story that she did for Misrata. And I saw her in the kitchen of this place before we were all due to leave. We were trying to catch a coffee and she was there smoking, you know, as ever. She was a ferocious smoker. And she said, "Look, Earl, I'm not going back on the boat. I've decided to stay," which was a surprise to no one. And she said, "My stuff is still all over the room in Benghazi in the hotel. So do you mind just like pack it up and tell the hotel I'll settle the bill when I come back?" I said, "Sure." So, you know, we were ordered out onto the boat by the BBC and off we went. And Marie stayed and I went back and packed up her hotel and we had a bit of an email exchange afterwards. And I said, "Look, the stuff is all there." And that was the last contact I had with her. And I heard her on the night before she was killed on Channel 4 and on CNN and indeed on the Beeb. And it sounded like the seventh circle of hell. And I remember thinking, "God, I must drop her a line just to say, be careful." And then I thought, she's not going to have time to read it. And I didn't do it. And I'll always be sorry that I didn't. But I think Marie, of everyone, would have known in her own heart and mind that that was the way she was going to go. She wasn't going to make old bones. You know, she wasn't going to retire. And I think if you read the book, it's very, very clear that she knew the consequences and she knew the risks. And she was always ready to take them. Just an absolutely extraordinary woman, but great fun. And when I was starting out, she was already hugely well established. I mean, she was a, you know, Sunday Times superstar. But she never behaved like that. She was always ready to sit down in the corner and have a gossip and, you know, share a story and have a great night. And she lived a very rich life. You know, she was more than somebody who went to war zones when she wasn't in war zones. She led a very full life.
Orla Guerin heard on Sunday with Miriam, and you can hear the full interview with Orla on the RT Player. Over on Drive Time, Philip Boucher-Hayes was interviewing independent TD Matty McGrath about the outcome of his meeting with executives of KBC Bank. It was a meeting arranged in the wake of a sit-in by Matty and two other TDs at a KBC branch in Baggot Street. And they were protesting at the approach taken by the bank in the controversial Roscommon eviction case just before Christmas. But things got a little hot under the collar, shall we say, when Philip tried to drill down into the detail.
"We're bailed out, the bank, the public did. So now it's not fair to allow citizens to be turned to the wolves. We must defend them. As I said, people who want to pay and make an effort to pay, not people that have no intention of paying, we don't have any truck for those. So I reject that utterly.
I know, but there isn't a judge in any court anywhere in this country who is going to give an eviction order for people who are attempting to pay. It is only in the event of long-term non-engagement or a refusal to pay that eviction orders have been given. So, you know, I come back to...
I've been down in the court several times. My picture vessels go down and our team cover the courts and see the distress on people's lives so they don't get legal representation or otherwise. So that's totally untrue. And just because programs like yours and others are sponsored by KBC and Danske Bank and others, you don't have to defend the banks utterly. I'm representing the people. I don't apologise to you or anybody else for it. And I'm not causing trouble or driving up interest rates.
Well, we are on behalf of the producers of this programme and indeed of myself, I reject absolutely the suggestion from you, Matty McGrath, that this programme or any other programme on RTE has ever shown partiality towards the banks because of their sponsorship of a programme. I would invite you to withdraw the remark as well if we're to continue this interview.
You just have, Fergal, you just said that.
No, my name is Philip and I haven't. I have asked you some questions.
And you asked me...
And you haven't answered the questions at all, Matty McGrath.
You were trying to blame me for interest rates going up. That's an outrageous, silly and beneath you really to suggest that. I'm saying that I have a duty to represent the public. I'm doing so. I'm elected by them for the time being. I will continue to do so. With a meaningful,
and before you occupied the bank, did you discuss with those that you were claiming to represent on that day that you were going to occupy the bank?
Did you
secure the consent of all of those KBC customers that you were representing before occupying the bank?
It was my third time going to the bank. I had gone there over a year ago. I had gone there again in the last.
Did you secure the consent of those that you were claimed to represent before you occupied the bank?
Any customer I represent, I have written authorisation to represent them. So don't tie me up in that. I have, because the bank won't discuss with any politician or anybody else.
And did you have their written consent to launch an occupation protest?
I have their written consent to deal with the bank in whatever way I feel.
I asked you, did you have their written consent to launch an occupation protest, which could conceivably have aggressed the bank towards them? Did you get their written consent for that?
Listen, do you get written consent from the public to allow the sponsorship from banks that are evicting people and terrorising people? So you don't, obviously. So we'll go back to that again. I represent people.
Which is
whatever,
manifestly a ridiculous suggestion.
Yeah, it's not at all. I'm just saying that it's the truth, unfortunately.
No, Matty McGrath, I'm asking you questions in exactly the same way that I would ask questions of the bank. It's called journalism. Now, you might try and answer the questions.
Very biased journalism, I find. I go down to the courts any day, the High Court.
Where we report from on an almost daily basis.
No more red meat for them boys. Philip Badger-Hayes with Matty McGrath, slugging it out on Wednesday's Drive Time. Hugh Jackman's latest film is The Frontrunner. He plays US Senator Gary Hart, whose political campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1988 was seen as a given. That is, until it was blasted apart by the revelation of his extramarital affair with Donna Rice on a yacht called Monkey Business. Hugh Jackman was Ryan Tuberty's guest yesterday.
We had your pal Russell Crowe with us on our talk show here a few times.
Ah, he's awesome. Always interesting.
Always interesting, except that we went for a couple of drinks afterwards and I'm only a skinny guy and he's not.
Yeah, yeah. No, he calls me a complete lightweight,
yeah,
which I am.
Yeah.
But I say to Russell, I say, everyone is kind of, when they go out to a pub with you, a kind of lightweight.
That's what I was thinking.
I leave his house. I don't even say goodbye to him because he'd be like, get back here, Jackman. I just, you know, I can't keep up. well done. I'm, again, courageous.
If you slip out from a night out like that, that's called an Irish goodbye, where you just go, I can't take anymore, but I don't want
I've
to say goodbye.
That, but why is that?
I know in my case, where if I slip away after a few drinks, is that I don't want to kind of say to everyone, bye, everybody. I don't want to fuss. I don't want anyone going, where are you going? I just want to just go see you. And you keep going and have the crack.
Is it because if you're there going, Ryan, see you later, and everyone's like, get back here, Ryan, it's only 11:30. Come on, sing. Will they give you a hard time?
Yeah, of course. And you'd get the same. You're coming over here to do all your nights here for your one man show are sold out.
Can I do the Irish goodbye on stage? That could be a first.
Then you have no fans.
Three quarters of the way through the show.
Who am I?
I could do it in Dublin. Who am I? And then it just goes, the dancers come on.
Yeah.
And there's about a 5-minute period. Like, is he coming back? And then I'll just post, guys, that was my Irish goodbye.
And they're all sitting there going, there must be something left in him. There must be something.
I wanted to honour you guys.
Well, the pair eventually got around to discussing the frontrunner, and of course the conversation naturally turned to American politics, Trump style.
And it's very hard, Hugh, not to watch a movie like yours, like The Frontrunner, without looking at it through a Trumpian prism. Do you know? Are you gone? Did they cut us off? Are you gone, Hugh, or can you hear me? Can Hugh hear me now? No. Okay. Well, I'll probably have to do
that.
Well,
was my Irish goodbye.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Gotcha.
You actually just trolled me. You dog.
You come on, it was nice. I left it to the last minute.
Yeah, but it was great. Oh, I did. But you completely got me.
It was to say, I know.
You did an Irish goodbye. Now I know how it feels. I was so impressed by myself and my Trumpian prism.
It was.
And you just threw it back in my face.
They should do a double act, Hugh Jackman with Ryan Tubridy yesterday. Meanwhile, over on the live line, Tekla Fowler rang Joe.
New Year's Eve, what happens?
So I am there on my own, minding my own business, watching the television. Doorbell rings at 9:15, wasn't expecting anybody. Tried to look out through the kitchen to see if I could see, but my light had gone off. So I went to the door, but didn't open it, and said, right. Who's that? And this male voice replied, and I quote, it's Shane Ross, your local TD, just calling to wish you a Happy New Year. And I replied to him, basically, what was he thinking of calling unannounced at that time of night in the dark to people's doors and expecting them to answer the door? And he didn't really have an answer, so I kind of dispatched him. Yeah. So I then rang my neighbour across the road and she said, I know, he's been. And my friend across the road didn't answer the door to mine either. When you're told by the guard not to answer the door at night to unknown callers, what was he thinking of?
But yeah? we do have, it's called parish pump politics, and we do have a connection, we're told, with our local politicians, which other countries don't have. Would you put that benign frame on it, Tekla?
I would, but you don't expect somebody to call at night, a winter's night, in the dark, New Year's Eve.
Well, while some other listeners rang in to give out, Tony Whelan, one of Minister Ross's constituents, said he didn't see any harm at all in the minister wishing people Happy Christmas or Happy New Year.
You're in Georgetown, and as Miriam Lord famously christens Minister Ross, Lord Georgetown, isn't it?
No, 2 weeks before Christmas, he rang the bell at our house. It was about 6:30 or 6:45.
Okay.
It was a Sunday night, actually.
Yeah.
And he came here, asked him a few questions, and he stayed about 10 minutes, and then he went to the house next door. But on Christmas Eve, I was coming off from Dundrum at the early mass. Yeah. It was about 7:45. And next thing, I see a guy with a Santa hat leaping out from gardens. I said, I think I'll cross over here. But then he approached me. I'm Shane Ross. I said, I know you. I said, you were in my house 2 weeks ago. Oh, he said. Well, he said, happy Christmas and Happy New Year. But I didn't see anything wrong with it.
Yeah. And he was nice and friendly and...
Absolutely.
But did he say to have any problems?
No, he didn't. No. I mightn't have looked like a fellow with a problem.
So then fast forward, Tony, to Christmas Eve, and then fast forward exactly a week later to New Year's Eve. What do you think of him canvassing those two occasions? Do you think that's a little bit
maybe
different?
Maybe he's overeager. I don't know. Maybe I have to say I vote for him.
Well, maybe he knows there's an election coming sooner rather
than later. And the other thing is people say, you never see these guys only when there's an election. You
that's
know,
a good
now
point,
I know coming out Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve is the other end of the scale. But I mean, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Well, as it happened, the minister himself was listening into Liveline and he took the opportunity to talk to Joe.
First of all, were you canvassing on New Year's Eve around 8:45?
I don't know. I wasn't exactly a canvass. What I was doing is I was knocking on a few doors of a few houses in the area and just saying, hey, Happy New Year. I'm your TD. I don't get to see you very much because I'm quite busy. Is there anything you want to raise with me? And I hope you have a good time. And I did that, on several occasions around that period. And on the whole, got a really good welcome. People were really nice and really delighted to see me, rather surprised, admittedly. And I take on board the point of the woman who said, you know,
Tekla,
it was dark.
Yeah. Tekla
and I think that's a fair point. But I was wearing a high-vis on all occasions, and I was standing in the light and didn't have to answer the door. But on the whole, nearly everybody answered the door, and we're quite honestly delighted to see you. A bit surprised.
So you are one of the gilets jaunes. You're wearing your yellow jacket. But Paddy, you work with the elderly. You can make your point directly there to the minister.
I've been working with the elderly for more than 50 years, and the greatest problem they have
those who are living alone, they are living in fear. They are nervous. We have of all the various crimes being committed. I admire the work you do. You're a good man, but I think you made a wrong decision here. And
you've got a good point there. And, you know, that's not the intention at all. And
oh, I really understand
was,
that
it was a tiny,
well.
It was a tiny minority. And the vast majority, Paddy, to be honest, and that includes the elderly, were actually delighted. They were a bit shocked because they never see ministers doing
okay,
this. But
okay.
What they don't realise is ministers, certainly there's no other time except the dark that I can do it at the moment.
Yeah,
go out and do it. And certainly during the Doyle period, there isn't the time available. So I had to balance the two of them. But I'm sorry if you think I did wrong in that. I just wanted to meet people. It's an opportunity to meet them and say hello.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Wednesday. On the gathering yesterday, Miriam O'Callaghan's panel, TD's Richard Boyd-Barrett and Finian McGrath, and journalists Alison O'Connor and Brenda Power also discussed Minister Ross's canvassing strategy. But the news that more than 40,000 nurses are set to go on strike on six dates from the end of this month was also a hot topic.
I mean, I think a lot of people, Miriam, are conflicted about this because, like everybody who has ever been in hospital or had a child in hospital, you can't speak highly enough of Irish nurses. And as you say, Richard, they are predominantly women. But at the same time, you know, they are, as you say, subject to a public service pay deal. And also last September, I think it was, the Public Service Pay Commission found, and that's chaired by a former trade unionist, that retention and recruitment were not subject to the pay issue, that this was simply about money. Now, you couldn't pay nurses enough, I guess. I don't know. I wouldn't do it what they do for diamonds. But at the same time, I'm just not convinced that 12% is going to bring an influx of nurses, Irish nurses, home from lovely health services like Canada, for instance, even functioning ones like the NHS in the UK. Because the problem here is the HSE is a basket case. That's why people are fleeing it. That's why doctors are fleeing it. That's why nurses are fleeing it. And I don't believe that the pay increase that they'll end up, which they will end up with maybe a slight increase or whatever improved conditions they will get after talks, which will be inevitable because it will have to be resolved by talks, that's not going to change the fundamental problem with the HSE.
I think it's going to sound contradictory when I say, do I understand why nurses are doing this? I say yes. Do I agree with it? No. I think that at this point in time, the idea of the knock-on effect in terms of pay agreements, I just think it's really irresponsible considering the uncertainty we're facing with Brexit and everything. I wouldn't fancy a job as a nurse, like everybody else said. I think they do an incredible job in a really dysfunctional system. But the flip side of it is that we don't know what we're facing nationally. And it's not just we see what's gone on in the US this week. We are on either side two countries that are basket cases. And I think that when you consider that Irish nurses, in terms of European leagues, they're not at the top, but they're quite near the top. So, I mean, I have an awful lot of sympathy, but I think that the timing is all wrong.
Alison O'Connor and Brenda Power with Miriam O'Callaghan yesterday. Freelance journalist Tanya Sweeney is a regular contributor to The Ray D'Arcy Show. This week, she was talking about the 300,000 people worldwide who are doing veganuary. And of course, her specialist mastermind subject, expecting her first baby at the age of 42.
That article is in The Independent today.
Yeah.
You are a freelance journalist, so we're talking to you about how you're documenting your pregnancy in the Irish Times.
Media tramp.
Yes. So how far in are you?
35 weeks. 35 it feels weeks. Like 135 weeks.
And how do people phrase that when they talk to you? How far? When are you due? What did they say?
Well, I was in the Trocadero on Christmas Eve and this man came up to me and pointed at me and went, now, is that going to be Noel or Nullig? And I went, it's not till February.
Yeah, right.
And he pointed at me and he went, there's six of them in there. And I was like, yeah, probably. It feels like it sometimes, you know, so...
People feel that it's okay to comment, don't they?
Yeah, I think I'd heard this from people before that, you know, you're sort of open season. Like people, I think this might be the Twitterization of humanity. People just are a pundit on everything at the moment, whether it's Brexit or my bump. So everyone has an opinion. If they say, you know, what kind of names are you thinking of? I'll mention X and Y. And they'll go, oh. And it's like, this is not your decision to make. Go have your own kid and call them what you want.
I suppose the fact that you were writing about it does give them...
Yeah, it's like a public
property.
A free
pass, doesn't it? Yeah. A free pass to comment.
Yeah, but I mean, you do get used to it. I mean, the advice is really something else. And I know a lot of it is coming from a really generous place, you know, but...
What sort of advice are you getting?
Well, I might say to somebody, you know, as a joke, oh gosh, you know, just put me under for this whole childbirth thing. God, can't be doing with it.
Yeah.
And they'll go, now you do understand that... So you C-sections are, you know, they have a risk and there's this and they pull you through everything. And you'll then, of course, find out that they did it a certain way. And what they're doing, really, people are just validating their own choices more than telling you what's going to suit your life. You know, or if, say, the breast and bottle feeding thing is a huge one, you know, but no one will go, now you're a freelancer. So, you know, maybe the bottles might work for you. They always go breast. No, no, no. You have to do it this way, the way I did it. You know, it gets really boring.
Now that you've brought it up.
Go on.
Well, are you going to breastfeed your child?
Do you know what? This is how I'm going to approach everything moving forward. I'm going to give it a lash, Jack. And if it, you know, breaks me, we shall move on and think of something else. But I'm not going to be one of those people who goes, oh, my heart was broken for 6 months over this, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm just not going to do that.
Tanya Sweeney with Ray Darcy on Wednesday. Keeping a diary is a rite of passage. And when Brona McTasney found one of her old teenage diaries in the back of a drawer, she and her sister laughed their heads off when they read it out loud all those years later. But given that the diary was written in 1981, the year of the hunger strikes, in between the entries about boy crushes, mad hairstyles and pop music, there was a real sense of the troubles in Northern Ireland. And that's how her Twitter account, at Norn Iron Girl, 1981, was born. Brona was Ryan Tuberty's guest on Tuesday.
It kind of gives us great insight into pop culture, but also the political climate of the time. It's multifaceted in that regard.
It is, but I mean, not intentionally. You know, I was 13 years old, and I think when you're that age, what's happening in your life is as big, if not bigger, than what's happening in the outside world. And I had this kind of pretension that I was going to be a journalist or something, and this just compulsion to write everything down. So it's really packed with like a real mixture of things that you would expect a 13-year-old's diary to have, you know?
Yes.
Because of the year that it was, in 1981, which is a pretty pivotal year in the history of Northern Ireland, and just being 13. So it's a mixture of, you know, boys and school, and then there's the Troubles, and that was the year of the hunger strikes. So it's all in there, really.
It really is. And let us go neatly to March the 1st. This was Permgate, the day that your mother decided it's time to perm up.
Yeah, yeah. Tonight, Mummy permed my hair. It's not as bad as I thought it would be. It's nice and curly, although it was nicer when it was wet. No. The police are on my tape now. Just finished the do-do-do-da-da-da, which is a silly long title, I think. And at the very end, it says, Start of Hunger Strike.
Right. And so you got the perm in, you got the police, the do-do-do, da-da-da-da, and then you've got that kind of savage note at the end, which, of course, it would become as the start of the hunger strike. And this is where your diaries start to get darker, certainly, but possibly more aware, or the political climate is so part of your life that it permeates your diaries.
The hunger strikes were huge, you know, and I think for us at that age as 13-year-olds, there was this weird connection between the hunger strikers almost being like a pop band to us, say to the likes of Madness, that I loved at the same time. So there was a weird kind of juxtaposition of, you know, growing up knowing all their names as much as knowing the names of pop bands. I had a Hunger Strike poster up beside my Madness poster. I had all kinds of Give Ireland Back to the Irish posters up beside my posters that I'd cut out of smash hits.
Yeah.
Brona McTasney is heard on the Ryan Tuberty Show on Tuesday. One of RTE's great innovators left the building this week after 40 years as a radio producer. Ian Wilson has been producing countrywide in recent years, but he was Dave Fanning's original producer when 2FM started in 1979, and he was responsible for setting up the now legendary Fanning Sessions, giving young bands their first experience in a recording studio in RTE. Well, Ian remembered the glory days with Dave and Jim Lockhart on last Saturday morning's Dave Fanning Show on 2FM.
We went out of our way to support you too at the start. And it was a smart decision, of course. They turned out to be the biggest band in the world. So if you're going to stick all your eggs in one basket,
it's a good basket.
It's a damn good basket to stick it into.
Well, when we, like, I came in from the band I played most in Pirates was U2, and the first session we did was U2. Now, that I don't remember the session really at all. You have a copy of it.
Oh, I have a copy.
I don't.
Oh, they have a copy, but nobody wants to hear it again.
Yeah, you stick it up on YouTube, they make a fortune.
Yeah, we'll give that a miss.
Was it a good session? I can't remember it.
It was live. What it was, we knew the studio existed. I had never heard an actual live noisy band in it, so we invited them in just on a one-off. Like, come in.
Yeah, I remember that.
Let's have a go, and let's see what it sounds like. Let's see what we can do in the studio. Do you mind coming in?
Were they your actual first session?
Yeah, it was actual first session. Yeah.
Wow.
You too. Well, if you're going to start anywhere, you might as well start there. I mean, if you're thinking,
if you're going to start doing sessions, if you're on the BBC, you'd start with the Beatles. So if we're going to start a session, we start with you too.
Ian Wilson also devised the 2FM Lark in the Park and Beat on the Street gigs and the Cork Rocks Showcase. What's less known is that he was responsible for commissioning a little-known comedy sketch called Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Ian Wilson might be responsible for all that we've said here and pat him on the back, but what you're really responsible for is one of the biggest comedy successes in the history of comedy in this part of the world. You started Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Yeah, I commissioned Mrs. Brown's Boys in the early days. Yeah, essentially Garrett O'Callaghan had been to see Brendan O'Carroll's show, and he brought Brendan in and said, Brendan has an idea to do something. So I sat them down and I came up with a system, a soap opera anyway, 5 days a week, 5 minutes a day, soap opera, Mrs. Brown's Boys. And now, I don't remember this, but Rory Cowan, who's just left Mrs. Brown's, tells me that they came in for the first rehearsal and the woman who was to play the grandmother, Mrs. Brown, couldn't make it to the rehearsal. They're all part-timers. So Brendan read the lines and I came up at the end of it and said, Brendan, that was absolutely brilliant. You should do Mrs. Brown, not bring in that... Yeah, and
the rest is
history. Ian Wilson with Dave Fanning last Saturday. In the annual Poetry Aloud competition, students from schools all around Ireland stand up in front of a panel of judges and recite poems by heart. In last Sunday's Lyric FM feature, Claire Cunningham told the story of the 2018 competition and she met the students, teachers and organisers involved. The winner was announced at the final in the National Library of Ireland last Monday, and the programme ended with the overall winner, Magella Votta, speaking Seamus Heaney's lovely poem, The Rain Stick.
The Rain Stick by Seamus Heaney. Upend the rain stick, and what happens next is a music that you never would have known to listen for. In a cactus stalk downpour, sluice rush, spillage and backwash come flowing through. You stand there like a pipe being played by water. You shake it again, lightly, and a diminuendo runs through all its scales like a gutter, stopping, trickling. And now here comes a sprinkle of drops out of the freshened leaves, then subtle little wets off grass and daisies, then glitter drizzle, almost breaths of air. Upend the stick again. What happens next is undiminished for having happened once, twice, 10,000 times before. Who cares if all the music that transpires is the fall of grit? Or dry seeds through a cactus. You are like a rich man entering heaven through the ear of a raindrop. Listen now again.
Magella Votta there from Mercy Montauk Secondary School in Tralee, overall winner of the 2018 Poetry Aloud competition. And you can listen back to the full Poetry Aloud programme on the Lyric feature page. Well, the former Irish Times literary correspondent and author Eileen Battersby died in a car crash just before Christmas. In one of the many tributes to her, her friend, Booker Prize winner John Banville, said she could write on any subject, from archaeology to music to running and horsemanship. He described her as a shining light. Eileen was a regular contributor to RTÉ radio programmes, and here she is now in conversation with the poet Theo Dorgan on an edition of The Art Show, which I heard on Bowman Sunday 8:30.
I think the first time I read Moby Dick, I was around 10. I'm not right. trying to make out I was a child prodigy or anything. I wasn't. But just that I read a lot
Big
of those books.
To bite off.
Yeah, but when you read a lot of those books at a very early age, and I mean, these are books that you can come back to over and over and over again. I mean, I don't know how many times at this stage I've read Jane Austen's novels, each of them. But, you know, the first time this kind of dramatic sort of, you know, you're responding almost like the child's fairy tale escape into a story. Mm. And then the more you read it, the more the layers emerge. And you start looking at it from the point of view of social history and behaviour and attitudes to men and women, differences, things like that. So it's funny the way the whole book thing shapes that sort of thing.
Well, specifically the novel.
Yeah.
Which I suppose has to be described as one of your grand passions.
Ah, yeah. But I think, too, the thing about the novel is that the more you read, the older you get, the more the layers peel off. You learn more and more social history. And I suppose, like most people, I'd say that I learned most of my French social history from reading Zola. Mm. And then you go and you read the history books. I've always read the novels and the history books parallel. Mm. And probably would read
more.
Did
you study history?
I did, yeah. I did English and history, but I did postgrad in English. Mm-hmm. But I've always been terribly interested in history, no matter whether it's medieval history, very interested in the Reformation, the Renaissance, or particular obsession. I mean, it's beyond a passion, but an obsession was the Second World War.
And talking about rereading, one of her books was entitled Second Readings, in which she chose a diverse number of novels which she enjoyed reading a second time or more often. And she included Black Beauty, as she told Miles Dungan in this interview.
So I was standing there, tap on the shoulder, and I turn around and think, oh, this is so embarrassing. Am I putting the dog food, the cat food in my pockets? Oh, I turn around and there's a man standing there. Now, he was not in a security uniform. And he looked at me and he said, I'm 59 years old. And I kind of thought, ah, oh, this is interesting. I'm 59 years old and I've never read Black Beauty. I said, ah, but he said, but I read what you wrote. It made me read the book and the book made me cry. Thank you. Good night. Look at it, this is fantastic. But that's what you get, and that's what books do. It's like this communal club, and it's just brilliant. No matter how many times I've had the experience and the privilege of somebody coming up, total strangers, saying, I read that book, thank you for that book. And you kind of think, gosh, it's, and that's the buzz. Like, I mean, I don't break the big news stories.
The late Eileen Battersby, and may she rest in peace. And John Bowman concludes his tribute to her on tomorrow morning's edition of Bowman, Sunday 8:30, here on RT Radio 1. But I leave you now with the ship's song from Camille O'Sullivan, which I heard on Sunday with Miriam. Gurmaga Vasragoluder, Tasulam Gurwanchiv, Saltasaglar, Agus Gamashiv Lum, Taka and Amakena, and Tachtan Chahogin, Gajishin, Gajeshap Slan.